From WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio, you're listening to Season 2 of Who Lies Beneath the Asylum. I'm Sherry Russo. This is a podcast about restoring dignity and respect by giving a voice to the voiceless. As we told you last season, the Old Athens Lunatic Asylum is a beautiful set of buildings that sit on top of a hill overlooking the college town of Athens, Ohio. Originally, the sprawling grounds were a park-like setting with gorgeous ponds, gardens, and fountains, and that was intentional, as this asylum and many others across the country were developed under the idea of moral treatment, a method of treating mental illness that emphasized the value of well-organized daily routines for patients. Dr. Thomas Story Kirkbride, a psychiatrist, went on to combine the moral treatment concept with his theories of hospital design and construction to develop the Kirkbride Plan, which guided the creation of the Athens Asylum, as well as dozens of others across the United States. Of course, as you know, on the asylum grounds in Athens, there are three cemeteries where approximately 1,900 patients who weren't claimed by their families when they died were buried. Many of the tombstones are only marked with numbers without names or dates. And we now know that Athens isn't alone in this approach to burying those who were not claimed by their families when they died while they were institutionalized. While the Athens Asylum has numbered grave markers, some facilities did not mark the graves at all. They buried their unclaimed patients in open fields. Doug McCabe is a retired library archivist and spent many years conducting research on the Athens Asylum and digging through old documents linking names and life stories with the numbers on the grave markers. Doug, welcome back for season two.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So the way those who were unclaimed were buried in the Athens Asylum was likely not what Thomas Story Kirkbride intended with his moral treatment and Kirkbride plan. Tell us about his Quaker background and what the Kirkbride plan was designed to do for those with mental illness.
Well, the Kirkbride plan was initiated in the 1840s and 50s with an effort to devise the best of European and American thoughts on how to deal with people suffering from mental distress. This moral treatment, of course, included patient treatments, but also took into consideration location, housing, feeding, clothing, and staff interactions that were just as important, if not more so. And then all of this fit in closely with Kirkbride's lifelong Orthodox Quaker religion. The original Athens Asylum layout and organization was true to that plan, accepting his belief such institutions should be no larger than housing about 250 patients. The Athens Asylum was built to house over 500 patients, and beginning in the early 20th century, expanded to house up to double that by the 1960s.
Wow. Do you think, you know, the beauty, we talk a lot about how beautiful the Athens Asylum facility is and was, and there's this contrast in the stories of what actually happened to some of those who were housed there. Do you think that contrast is a reason so many people are drawn to learning about what happened there, and in our case specifically, those who were buried under the numbered tombstones?
Well, the outward beauty of the asylum is well documented in, say, there are lots of photographs now housed at Ohio University Archives that glorify, if you will, the lakes, the waterfalls, the topiary work, the walkways and orchards and vineyards and gardens. Even the interior of the building featured large rooms, high ceilings, mosaic tiled floors, a ballroom, a chapel, administrative rooms, even apartments for some of the staff, cafeterias, kitchen and laundry facilities, day rooms and private rooms for patients. So that all shows a great interest in detail and design, and the hope that this provides an intentional asylum or sanctuary or a calming place, a place for recovery of patients. And while the facility did a pretty good job for that, a patient treatment really relied upon the quality of the administrators and the staff their training, their behavior, and their actions. So not like other institutions in the community, even say Ohio University in the town of Athens across the river, you were still faced with a few bad apples among many good staffers. And this goes for patients too, who mostly were placid, recuperative, and might only be there for a month or so. But there were still some who were angry, violent, and could be there for years or even decades. And all of these types are represented in the cemeteries.
Okay. Well, we spoke recently with Robert Kirkbride, who is a descendant of Thomas Story Kirkbride and professor of architecture and product design, and is also the spokesperson and a founding trustee for Preservation Works, a nonprofit organization advocating for the preservation and adaptive reuse of Kirkbride Plan psychiatric hospitals. Here's what he had to say about the original concept behind the hospitals.
Well, Thomas Story Kirkbride's approach was, as I mentioned, extremely imbued with the Quaker approach of believing that every soul, every person contains a light and contains the possibility of resuscitation, recuperation, transformation. And therefore, the Quakers were committed to precisely people who oftentimes were left at the margins. That included prisoners. It included the mentally ill. And therefore, what he was informed by his experience at the Frankfurt Retreat, the Friends Retreat in Northern Philadelphia, was the potential to use what was called the moral treatment, which had been developed in Europe, in France, and in England, as a way of treating patients with respect. It was centered on respecting patients and caring for them in ways that put their needs first. And what Thomas Story brought to that particular conversation was that the physical environment was critical to provide beauty as therapy, to provide sensorial experiences, fresh air, outdoor spaces, beautifully landscaped properties, in order to help people transform their personal habits. And the buildings themselves were a physical embodiment of the progressive structure of the day, the regimen of the day that he believed, and others, his colleagues, believed would help restructure the habits and behaviors of the occupants to strengthen them, to bring their confidence back. And therefore, occupational therapy also was gardening, for example, or mending clothes, basket weaving, skill building. All of these activities were part of the day-to-day life of the asylum itself, or the hospital, as he would call it. He was very specific to call it a hospital.
Joining us now is Paul LaRue. Paul's a retired social studies teacher and history buff and is on the State Board of Education in Ohio. He's also conducted research projects involving veterans and unmarked graves. Paul, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Sherry.
Of course. So, Paul, we've talked about the intention of the Kirkbride Plan was to create beautiful spaces for recovery. But as we now know, that moral, humane treatment didn't always happen at the Kirkbride facilities and other institutions. Can you explain the context of what was going on at the time and maybe why Kirkbride's idea didn't work out the way he intended?
Absolutely. Dr. Thomas Kirkbride, a Pennsylvania physician, had advocated for a change in the way the mentally ill were perceived and treated in the second half of the 19th century. And it was more than just a single thing. It was everything from the way the buildings were constructed, the use of language, mentally ill versus lunatic asylum. And an especially important part was the inclusion of nature and vocational training. Now, to put this in context, the second half of the 19th century, the use of nature became a really important piece of therapy. An interesting example in Ohio is the Dayton National Soldiers Home. In 1897, it was the home to 5,000 Civil War veterans. It was the largest in the United States. It was on 600 acres, and there were flowers and green space and fresh air. And the idea absolutely was that the men would be better off or treated with the use of nature. It also, and just as an interesting bit of trivia, in 1900, there were more than 150,000 visitors per year, and they came to see this nature. It's interesting, you know, in 2022, there were 30,000 homeless veterans in the United States, half of them living on the street. And I'm certainly not saying that we should go back to the soldier's home, but it's interesting how we look at how we treat, you know, how we treat our veterans, how we treat it. And the use of nature was real important. One more piece of that was the rural cemetery movement. I mean, I know we talk a lot about cemetery. The rural cemetery movement was the idea that cemeteries were meant to be more than just a place to warehouse the dead. And so they started to include trees and winding paths. And it became a really, cemeteries were meant to be something of beauty. And in fact, we just did our local cemetery tour in Washington Courthouse over the weekend. And as I was sitting there, I was one of the volunteer, you know, interpreters. And I was looking at the trees and the winding paths. And it was, you know, they were really meant to be, again, more than a warehouse. You know, unfortunately, like a lot of things, the way that the mentally ill were treated, in many cases, turned out to be a warehouse. So again, there were a lot of good intentions. It was actually, in some ways, they were ahead of their time. We always talk about today getting back to nature. But unfortunately, the reality often didn't live up to the promise.
Okay. Well, we know that there are many other unmarked burial grounds across the country that are associated with asylums, poorhouses, and prisons. And one of those is the Feeble-Minded Institute, where you've conducted research. Can you tell us about that institute and the cemetery that was associated with it?
Absolutely. What was known as the Feeble-Minded Institute was opened in the late 1890s at Orion, Ohio. It today is the current home of the Orient Correctional Facility. There was a farm. There was vocational training. You know, the idea of inclusion of nature and vocational training, you know, it was run for a number of years. And what we have left today are the 822 flat markers. And I must say, you know, when I had just moments ago talked about this rural cemetery movement, it's very institutional. You know, these are flat headstones with a number, and that's, you know, that's really all that's left of that today.
And has there been anything done to try to put named markers on those graves?
My students and I did a project with the correctional officers, took photographs of all the headstones, and they had provided us with information, and we matched up a lot of the information to put a database together. So, you know, we have a database with names, dates of death, some of, you know, cause of death. So we have a lot of that information, but I think it's still, you know, it's a really fascinating cemetery. I am a big cemetery geek. It started as a country cemetery, and then the Feeble-Minded Institute came in, so there's 822 from there, and now it is still actively used by the Orient Correction. So it is still actively used, and there are now prisoners who will die if their families don't claim them that are buried there.
What work are you doing right now in regards to this kind of identifying of people who might be buried under unmarked graves? Anything going on there?
I'm not in a classroom anymore since I retired, but I continue to work with groups. The VA is very committed because, I mean, there are still, I think, and my students used to think this, every soldier had a headstone. And the truth is, sadly, that's not the case. You know, working along with the VA on different projects and things, there's still an emphasis and an effort to get, you know, every veteran, regardless of race, gender, you know, nationwide, should have a marked grave. And we're not there yet.
Okay. Well, Paul LaRue, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
While there's so much work to be done around the nation to recognize those buried in unmarked graves, this season of Who Lies Beneath will continue to tell the life stories of those buried in Athens. Here's a preview of those we're going to hear from this season.
My name is Ruth Close. I was admitted to the asylum in 1924 as patient number 6419 from Washington County.
My name is William Black. I was admitted to the asylum as patient number 807 on April 2nd, 1878. I was 23 years old at the time. My admission records say I was institutionalized as a result from overstudy.
My name is Prudence Parkinson Kincaid, grave number 282, cemetery 1, buried 1908. But Athens wasn't my first asylum. I had already been institutionalized for approximately 25 years and was part of a high-profile transfer of what the newspapers called lunatic and imbecile inmates to the Athens Asylum in 1904.
We also want to hear your stories about long-lost relatives in your families who you believe may be buried under a numbered tombstone or an unmarked grave at cemeteries across the country. We'd love to share your story and see if the work done here in Athens might lead you to some answers and maybe even a named grave marker. Email us at wholiesbeneath@woub.org. Thanks for listening, and until next time, take care of each other. Who Lies Beneath the Asylum is a production of WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio, written by me, Sherry Russo. Adam Rich is our audio engineer, artwork by Sean Anderson. Special thanks to Doug McCabe, Robert Kirkbride, and Paul LaRue for contributing their knowledge and voice to this podcast. If you like this show, please rate and subscribe or visit woub.org to learn more.